Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. In the second half of today's show, New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of more than a dozen novels joins us. She's returning, I think, for the fourth time to our show, and her latest book is the second in her historical paranormal trilogy. She's MJ Rose, and her new book is called The Language of Stones. First, I'm pleased to welcome someone who's joining us for the first time today, and that's Mary McNear. She's the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of four novels and one novella. All five books are part of the Butternut Lake series published by HarperCollins, and she has an interesting story to share with us about how she started, or how she found the courage to write. Mary McNear, welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. Thank you so much for having me on your show today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I spent a lovely couple of hours reading your book yesterday in the heat wave.
I hope that there was a lake involved. If it couldn't be the Butternut Lake of the novels, I hope it was, or at the very least, another body of water.
There was definitely a beach involved.
Good.
Which is a good job because the weather's awful today.
I know. Well, I'm in San Francisco, so believe me, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I've learned to love the cold, foggy, windy summers here, but sometimes it can try my patience.
Well, you're originally from Wisconsin, I believe.
Yes, I'm originally from the Midwest. I grew up in Chicago, but I spent my summers in a cabin on a lake in the northern Midwest, and I still spend part of every summer there. So it's very close to my heart. And obviously it informs the series of novels I wrote.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, they say the best stories are those that we draw on from personal experience one way or another. And so you as a kid, I understand, used to love to go up to this cabin. It was your grandparents, was it? Is that right?
And yes, that's right.
You would tell these stories and became quite the well-known storyteller around the campfire.
Well, I was one of four girls in my family, and believe me, there was so much competition for our parents' attention, so you really had to kind of carve out your identity, and that was my identity. I was the storyteller, but the problem was I was the third of four girls, and I found that often the only people I could get to listen to my stories were my younger sister, my younger cousins, our neighbors. I mean, I basically forced other people to listen to my stories.
I used to do the same. I used to write plays, and I used to make, all of my mom, my friend's mom was so patient, and she didn't work, and so she would let us use her patio as my stage, and I'd direct the play, and I'd write the play, and we'd spend our pocket money on jumble sale ball gowns and stuff for theatrical costumes.
Well, it's interesting because when you're an adult, you appreciate those adults from your childhood so much.
Yes.
You do. I think you didn't understand at the time how much patience that must have taken them,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
to sit through like the third version of your play, right?
That's right. So let's talk about the book and how this happened for you, because you went away to college and you kind of gave up your aspirations
I did,
for writing.
Yeah. So my entire childhood I wanted to be a writer, and I mean books were so real to me that I didn't just read like Little Women or Little House on the Prairie or Jane Eyre. I really lived them. In fact, there was a long time during my childhood, I was so profoundly affected by the Little House series that when people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would say I wanted to be a pioneer. So that was the plan. It might not have been the best plan,
Right,
anyway, that was what I had in mind. So, but you're right. I went to college, and then after college, I went to graduate school, and I thought, I just was not brave enough to be a writer. I just decided that it took a certain kind of courage that I did not have. So I was married. I was in graduate school. My husband and I had a son. And when he was 3 years old, he was diagnosed with autism. And I felt like our whole world just imploded. I mean, I was so... There's no real way you can be prepared for having a child with special needs.
Right.
But I realized, you know, once I recovered from the shock, I realized I was going to have to rethink my life. And I was going to have to drop out of graduate school. It was so intense. And I knew that I was just going to have to give 100% to my son. And I did that. But about a year into that, I thought, you know, I have to do something for myself because I thought I just didn't think it was healthy to do what I was doing. I didn't have any kind of, just really any way to kind of express myself, you know.
Right.
So what I decided I would do is I would start writing novels and I would work on them for an hour a day because I thought that was the minimum amount of time that I would need to actually, over the long run, produce something. And I had no idea how difficult it was going to be. I mean, it was really hard. And I remember there was one day when I worked for an hour, and I did it in 12 5-minute increments.
Now, I don't know how...
As you can imagine, that was really frustrating.
Yeah, I don't know how you did that.
But I thought, you know, I'm going to do this. And honestly, Vicki, I think it saved me. I mean, I think it's the reason why I emerged from this experience with my sanity intact, because what I discovered about novels is, you know, people read them for escapism. Well, people write them for escapism, too.
Yes.
And that was my way not only of reconnecting with a part of my past that felt much simpler and much more, you know, much less complicated than my present, but it was also just a way of, just channeling that part of myself that I had really put on hold,
right,
you know?
Right.
I mean, that, I think, in many ways was my son's gift to me. Well, one of the many gifts.
Yes, and I want to talk about, we're going to get into this delightful series and the new book, The Space Between Sisters, in just after the break here. But before we go to break, I want to just go back to something you mentioned. And you said it wasn't until your son, you saw your son facing his daily challenges with autism that you found the courage to write. You didn't think you had the kind of courage it took to write. I understand that, but I think a lot of people don't understand, may not understand what you mean by the courage to write. So explain to us what that took for you as a person, as a writer, to put yourself out there.
Well, I think, first of all, I was a very, there was always a part of me that was creative, but there was also a part of me that, I was a good student because I loved the structure that college and graduate school provided. And I loved the idea of, you know, graduating with a degree or having a credential or, you know, I think I needed that kind of positive, that kind of structure in my life, but also
right.
that kind of positive reinforcement. And the thing about being a writer, at least at first, is, there are no guarantees at all. And I tell people, after I've given readings, I've had would-be writers approach me and ask me about it, and I'm happy to talk to them about it. But Vicki, I tell them the truth, and I say, I'm not an overnight success. I've been doing, or if I am an overnight success, I'm an overnight success after working on it for almost 20 years. I mean,
right.
My son's 21 now, so less than 20 years,
which is
coming
true,
up on 20 years.
Which is true of most overnight successes.
Yeah, I know. And I just realized when I first started writing, I thought, there's no guarantee it will ever be published. If it's published, there's no guarantee anyone will ever read it. And, when I did have to really steel myself for that rejection, too. And as any writers listening out there know, writing can be lonely. It can be scary. So I think those were all reasons why I really had to work up the courage to do it.
Right. And you wrote two novels to begin with that did not make it. And then finally you saw a new story. This is leading up to your series. You saw a new story that sparked an idea for you. It was about a young widow whose husband had died in Afghanistan and the challenges she faced raising her five-year-old son. And so then I read that you took that as the central question behind the novel. How would they overcome their grief, rebuild their life, etc.?
Absolutely. That was right, you know, at the height of the war in Afghanistan. I was watching the local news, and they interviewed this young woman who was standing on the front lawn of her house with her son. And I couldn't shake it. For a couple days, I thought about them, and I thought, you know, the problem with our media is that we'd never revisit them. We'd never know what happened to them. And I thought, you know, I'd like to think that their friends and family and neighbors would rally around them. But I thought, you know, what's the next chapter for them? And for some reason, around the same time, I started sort of seeing, just in my mind, this scene where a woman arrives with a child late at night at a cabin that's been closed for many years. She's reopening it. And I suddenly realized that woman in the novel could be my story about what happened next to that woman on the news. It could be a version of what happens to someone who has to start over again. And really, what better place to start over than some place that has a real emotional resonance with you? In her case, it was her family's cabin that she'd spent her childhood summers in.
Right.
But like so many of us, you know, it had sort of, you know, she hadn't been there for several years because the rest of life kept interfering with it. As life does,
yes. And we need to interrupt right there to take a commercial break. Part of our life here, right?
Yes.
And we'll be right back. We're talking with Mary McNear. Her new book is called The Space Between Sisters. It's part of the Butternut Lake series. And we're going to learn more about that new book when we come back. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I was sensitive to lights and sounds, so I'd build secret hiding places where they couldn't get in. Sometimes, I'd do the same things over and over, until one day, I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun. Coming July 25th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, The Whole Detox with Dr. Deanna Minich. She says it's not enough to just detox the body. You have to detox every area of your life for complete holistic health. This 21-day program will help you do that. We'll also hear from Dr. Craig Malkin, whose book, Rethinking Narcissism, helps you recognize and get rid of the narcissists who've infiltrated your life. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Ready to shake things up? Try Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. Well, we are talking right now with Mary McNear. She's a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of the Butternut Lake series. We're talking about the fourth book today. So, Mary, you were talking about how you got started and you got the three-book contract for your first Butternut Lake series, and then they extended another two-book contract to you. This is the fourth book. Am I correct in that?
Yes, you're right. Fourth of five.
And I read, I can't believe you do this because I could not resist, you write in a donut shop.
Yes, I do. And I always tell people that I have never ordered a donut there, which is absolutely true. At least I've never ordered a donut there when I was actually working there. Because I said, talk about a slippery slope. It would basically just be a downward spiral after that.
Yes, but, I can imagine. You'd start salivating.
I was looking for a place to write my novels because when I really started getting, when I really had fully committed to it, both my children were teenagers. And I just found that if I was at home, I was either watching CNN because I'm a complete news junkie, mm-hmm. or I was confronting literally mountains of laundry that was waiting to be folded. Or I was making appointments for them. I was making dermatological or orthodontic appointments for them. So I thought, I have to get out of the house or I will never be more than a personal assistant for
right.
my children.
Yeah, there's definitely something to putting that separation of space.
So in. I experimented with a couple places, and this place just felt right because, I'm was in my 40s at the time. And so a lot of San Francisco, a lot of the coffee houses here are sort of like, 23-year-old men, with high-end laptops wearing, they're wearing like $60 t-shirts,
Right.
And I just realized like, okay, that's not me. I'm not cool enough to work at that coffee house if that's who their
well, you are
regular
now.
Customer is. So, and what's great about this donut shop, too, is that I love to eavesdrop on people.
Yes, yes.
And after school, high school students, college students, younger people will come in after classes just to hang out. And not only have I written down things I've heard people say, I have put them in the novels, too. So, and I realized to people that age, if you're 40 or over, you're just invisible to them. You're not there. So it's been a great place to be a professional eavesdropper.
Yes, I think all writers are professional eavesdroppers. I know I am for sure. And I've actually pulled I've grabbed sound bites sometimes for certain things.
Well, and I always say about the young people who congregate there, I say, they have one thing on their mind, Vicky, and it's not donuts. I can
right.
tell you that right now. No,
right.
I'm kidding. Of
right.
course, it's donuts, too. But a lot of it revolves around flirtation, which, let's face it, it's just fun. It's fun to write about.
Well, let's talk about the space between sisters. I love the title of this book. I don't know why, but there's something that just resonated with me on the title. And I know what it means to me, but I'm wondering why you chose this title.
Well, it's interesting because on the one hand, the two sisters in the novel are very close. But on the other hand, one of them is keeping a secret from the other. And that secret has created this space between them over the last 13 years. Something happened to her when she was a teenager. Something happened to Poppy, who's one of the characters, and she never told her sister when. And it sort of marked that's when Poppy's life started to diverge from Wynn's. But it's also when you know, it's also when they stopped being as close to each other as they once were. I mean, in some ways, they're still very close. When Poppy shows up on Wynn's doorstep at this cabin, and she has no money and nowhere to live and, you know, nowhere to go, Wynn is 100% there for her. So it's not as if they're estranged from each other. But it isn't until they're completely honest with each other, really, that that they can bridge that space between them.
Right.
But I think that's something that's very common in relationships between siblings. You can be close on some levels and at the same time not close on other levels, you know. There, it's the complexity of that relationship that I find so fascinating.
Right. Well, as you said, they kept secrets from each other. And I was wondering, you know, have I kept secrets? Do I have secrets that I've kept from my sister? Does she have secrets she's kept from me? The same with my brother. Do you have secrets that you've kept from your sisters, your three sisters?
I do. And not, you know, when it's interesting, too, because I have a very different relationship with all three of them.
I would imagine,
so
yeah.
I don't necessarily, you know, share the same things with each of them, but they're definitely things that I have not told them. And I think in some ways, too, I'm always careful to make sure that the characters understand, you know, that sometimes we need to keep things from other people, and nothing is gained by that kind of honesty. There's some kind of honesty that doesn't necessarily help people, that can actually hurt people. But I felt in Wynn and Poppy's case, what had happened to Poppy as a teenager was preventing her from really moving on with her life, from really committing to anything, whether it was a relationship with someone or a job or even just a place. And so I felt like that was something that really did need to come out. And she really couldn't be honest about it with herself until she was honest about it with other people.
Yeah, interesting. The book begins with Poppy suddenly showing up on Wynn's, sure, Winona, on Wynn's doorstep one night in to this cabin that Wynn inherited. And she's got this guy, Everett West, in tow. Tell us a little bit about the differences between the sister, because you've touched on that a little bit. Poppy is very, very free-spirited, and Wynn is not.
No, she's... No, and it was interesting because they were both the product of a dysfunctional family, and I won't say how much of that may or may not have been influenced by my own parents. But, you know, it was a different generation,
right? Right, right.
Families were not necessarily as child-centered as they are now, right?
Right,
so
absolutely.
Really what they've done is they've both taken this childhood that was in some ways very, very chaotic, where there wasn't a lot of adult supervision, and they've both done something completely different with it. So Wynn is very... you know, she can border on, you know, she can be controlling, she can be neurotic. The novel opens with her rearranging her kitchen utensil drawer, which is something she'd just done like a week ago. So it's already perfectly arranged. But the way she deals with the fallout from her childhood is to have everything be very calm, very organized, you know. She needs to feel very much like she's in control, even though, of course, we know from the beginning that there are things in her life that she's not in control of, because we can't all always be in control of what's happening in our lives. And so Poppy has gone in a completely different direction. And, I mean, I think we all know somebody kind of like her. You know, she doesn't take her own life seriously. And it's hard not to like her because she's very free-spirited. She's very... she definitely has, you know, she has a very funny side to her personality, and she knows how to sort of bring out that side of Wynn. She knows how to tease her and kind of bring her a little bit outside of herself. But what I thought was interesting was how my sisters and I, you know, are all products of the same family, and yet we all have very different coping mechanisms that
Yes.
we took away with us.
Yeah, my mother always used to say that there's only 3 years difference between the three of us. But she always said she handled each of us very differently, especially as adults.
Yeah.
You know, because we're all different personalities as well. So I'm wondering, the dialogue in here is exquisite.
Well, thank you.
How do you go about approaching your dialogue? Because I know I've said this before on the show, but there are some books that I've had to put down because they can't tolerate the dialogue. It's so bad.
Well, you know, I think it helps, first of all, that I like to talk myself. I think it helps, too, that I grew up in a family where, I mean, Vicki, we talked and we talked and we talked. I remember a couple years ago, I read that that there was a study, and they had discovered that that men talked more than women. And, I mean, I don't mean to sound sexist, which I'm not, but I thought they needed a study to figure this out. Like, I could have told them that women talk more than men, right?
Right.
So partly that's a holdover from my childhood. But the other side of it, too, is I think I don't just like talking. I really like listening, too. So I'm always listening to people when I go out in public. And then one thing I think that helps with writing dialogue is I read books, but I also listen to books. And I don't know if you like doing that or not.
I do,
but
actually,
I find that I find it really helps me to listen to dialogue. And you're right. And sometimes I don't like it. And sometimes I think to myself, is that really how people talk? But the nice thing about being both a writer and a reader, of course, is you can take poetic license with it. So sometimes sometimes whether it's realistic or not is less important than just how it sounds. You know, the book I'm writing right now has a 13-year-old boy in it. This is the fifth and final book in the Butternut Lake series. And Vicki, it is so hard to write his dialogue because, as anyone who has ever known a 13-year-old well will tell you, boy, you know, they do not often speak in full sentences.
Right.
You know, it can be done, but not all the time.
Right. So as a writer now, I mean, you've got all these books under your belt. What has been the biggest challenge for you to keep going forward and keep evolving as a writer?
Well, you know, I think it was very important after book three, after the end of the trilogy, that I was able to introduce a new set of characters. Because one thing I found with the first three books is I loved the characters in them. But I remember when I finished the third book and I thought, you know, if I write another book with these characters in it, it would be a little bit like, you know, when you have another couple over for dinner and they stay late and everybody has a good time and then, you know, then they leave and you wash the dishes and you go to bed. Well, it would sort of be like writing another book at that point would sort of have been like the next morning if the doorbell had rung and that couple had come back again. Like, I know we had a great night last night, but look, here we are. We're here again. Like,
right.
We can start the whole thing over. And you would think to yourself, wait a second, you were just here.
Right.
So I really felt like with this book, with book four, that I needed to introduce a fresh group of characters. And that really kept me going. And I did have one person make a cameo who is Caroline Keegan, who's the woman who owns Pearl's, which is the coffee shop in Butternut. And then I found that because I did that, I was able, for book five, I am going back and I will be reintroducing some of the original characters from the first three books. I mean, the two main characters are new, but they are, one of them is connected to a character that that people will remember. So that helps, I think, to feel like, you know, if you can maybe not start over completely, but feel like it was kind of like a reboot, I think. That's how I like to think of book four.
Yeah. Well, you certainly sound as though you love doing what you're doing. I'm wondering what you know. You said you've been doing this for 20 years now, approximately. What do you know now that you wish you'd known back then?
You know, Vicki, I wish I'd known that when I first started out doing this, I remember the first novel I wrote. It was bad. There's no other word for it. And I knew it was bad. But I wish what I could have seen is that they would get better, you know. And I think that almost, I really do think that everyone was better than the one before it. And that, I think, is something maybe you can't explain that to someone, but I really believe that that was not a unique experience I had.
Right.
That the way to learn how to write a novel is to write a novel and then write another novel and then write another novel. So I wish that the future me could have offered some encouragement to the person who started doing this, thinking like, will I ever get better? This is not good enough. And I don't think it's supposed to be good enough unless you're a prodigy. And those people exist, but fortunately for the rest of us, they are in the minority.
Yeah, it's very, very rare that a first novel is picked up. I mean, seriously, isn't it? Because it is a craft, and we are supposed to practice, and we are supposed to get better.
No, it's true.
Yeah. So tell me, obviously you have a lot of discipline because you wrote, you said, in 5-minute increments just to get 1 hour of writing in a day when you first started out. What does discipline mean to you?
So, you know, I think sometimes it means different things. And, you know, sometimes I will tell myself that I have to write for a certain number of hours or write you know, a certain number of words. But I think really what it means is just is doing it every day, even on a bad day, even on a day where you don't feel like working. And maybe, you know, maybe you only work for an hour or two at the most. You know, I don't think every day can be equally productive, but I think it's just kind of slogging through the times when maybe you're not as excited about doing it. And then, you know, getting to those times where all of a sudden you are excited about it. I mean, I think it's just, it's the everyday. It's the day in and the day out. But every day, of course, is not going to be equally productive.
Well, Mary McNear, I appreciate you joining us today. It's wonderful talking with you. For our listeners, Mary is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author. Is this her fourth in the Butternut Lake novel? We're going to expect a fifth fairly soon, right?
Yes, in time for next summer.
There we go. This book just came out last month. It's called The Space Between Sisters, a Butter Lake novel. And you can find out more about Mary at marymcnear.com, marymcnear.com. Final very quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Mary.
Yes, if there are any aspiring novelists out there, start today.
There we go. You heard it from the pro. All right. Thanks for being with us, Mary. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Vicky. Bye-bye.
Bye. Please do stay with us. We will be right back. We will be joined by MJ Rose about her latest novel and look forward to talking with her again. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Coming July 25th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, The Whole Detox with Dr. Deanna Minich. She says it's not enough to just detox the body. You have to detox every area of your life for complete holistic health. This 21-day program will help you do that. We'll also hear from Dr. Craig Malkin, whose book, Rethinking Narcissism, helps you recognize and get rid of the narcissists who've infiltrated your life. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Northwest School of Animal Massage on Vashon Island, we cover the world of animals. This week, July 24th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. As an animal behavior therapist and trainer, I can help you understand your animal friends and resolve any problems you've got going on. We'll have open phone lines throughout the show, so plan to give me a call with your questions or call in about any animal-related topic on your mind. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
There's a reason they invented the internet. It's called 1150kknw.com.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. My guest in this segment is MJ Rose. She's the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of more than a dozen novels. She's also the co-president and founding board member of International Thriller Writers and the founder of the first marketing company for authors, which is AuthorBuzz.com. MJ, welcome. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to say MJ Rose's new book is called The Secret Language of Stones. Beautiful cover to this book for those who are watching on video. And I want to... This is a follow-up, actually, to the last book that we talked about. We talked to you last year about your last book. Yeah. That's how I count my years.
Me too.
And the last book was The Witch of Painted Sorrows, and we met Sandrine Salom, a woman who has an interesting past, let's just say, an interesting life. And this one really features her daughter. So tell us a little bit about this book and how it follows up on the last one, if you would.
Well, it actually doesn't follow up on the last one at all. So I'm writing books that absolutely are meant to be read as standalone.
Right. So it does stand alone. I know a lot of your reviewers say it's a sequel, and it's definitely not a sequel.
It's not a sequel. The characters in the first book, some of them are referred to once or twice in this book. But it's completely a standalone. It's 25 years later, and it's the main character is a completely different person. Her name is Opaline, and she's a young jeweler in Paris during World War One, and she's there making trench watches for soldiers, which trench watches were very important during the war because soldiers couldn't wear wristwatches because they were living in trenches, and the watches were getting smashed on the rocks. So jewelers made little cages, I like to call them, crisscross metal with openings in the middle that you snapped on top of your watch, and it protected the crystal. And she's working for a jeweler who worked for Fabergé, a Russian jeweler, who has recently emigrated to Paris. And Opaline is working for him and learning how to be a jeweler. And she has a little odd gift, which is that she makes talismans out of rock crystal and objects that belong to dead soldiers. And through these talismans, she can talk to the soldiers and get their dying thoughts, so she can give the thoughts to the mothers, wives, sisters, lovers, and daughters of the soldiers. Because World War One, I didn't know that much about World War One. It was the most devastating war to date.
Right.
There were over 1 million French soldiers killed. There were practically no men in France who weren't fighting, except for the old or the disabled or the young. And Paris was in mourning. Every day, thousands more young men and middle-aged men died. And Opaline is doing whatever she can to help alleviate some of that mourning and bring closure to this process for a lot of these mothers, sisters, wives, and lovers. And then one day, one of the soldiers talks to her directly, and she starts having basically a conversation with a ghost who she proceeds to fall in love with. But the book is very much about Paris during the war and how the war changed women. And all my books are really about women coming to terms with their power in whatever way that means, and becoming empowered to be who they are meant to be.
Yes, you do always have very strong women in your books. I think we talked a little about this last time, because obviously our media doesn't portray, you know, portrays that the perfect woman is a certain way. And your characters always have a lot of strength to them and are always very determined to go their own way. You know, one of the things that I found fascinating, I had a grandfather who was in the World War One, and so this book is set in the summer of 1918, which is towards the end of the First World War. And I found it fascinating when you talked about the mourning jewelry that she's creating for them, because I remember my grandmother had been given something that was passed down to her as a jewelry, as a mourning jewelry.
Uh-huh.
So how did you come across that idea? And because I've not heard that for years.
I was doing research on France and the occult, and came across a sentence in a book about all these women who started going to psychics during World War One to try to find out what had happened to their loved ones. And I had been collecting pictures of mourning jewelry, which really tend to be much older than my period. They tend to be Victorian and Edwardian. And I had been collecting pictures of them. There was an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum that I had just gone to that was an exhibit of mourning clothes and mourning jewelry, and I had become fascinated with it. And so I had just seen the exhibit, and then I read the sentence, and the two things just sort of merged in my mind, that what would happen if someone who had powers was making mourning jewelry that actually enabled you to connect to the dead. And that was sort of the genesis of the book.
Right, right. And you always have such interesting characters in here. I know not all the time, and I do remember you said this was totally accidental when it happened, but you sometimes have real characters, real historical characters in your books. Was there one in here? Because I couldn't find an obvious one.
Yes. Let's see. There are several. One is that there's a woman in the book who is a sculptress who works at a place in Paris where she works for a woman named Anna Ladd, and they make face masks for the soldiers who come back from war who have been disfigured, because World War One was the first war with so much disfigurement because of shrapnel.
Right.
So many boys and men lost pieces of their faces and ears. And so Anna Ladd, who was a real sculptress, created a studio in Paris. And then there was another sculptor who opened one in England, in London, who were making these masks. They took 6 months to make a mask. It was made out of tin. It was sculpted and then painted flesh colors. It was attached to glasses, usually. And it gave men the opportunity to have some dignity again, because their faces were horribly disfigured and people couldn't help but stare at them. Mm-hmm. And the staring was certainly not meant to be cruel, but it was horrendous. Men couldn't have dinner with their wives or children. They couldn't date. They couldn't meet women. It was tragic. And so this Anna Ladd, who was a real person, open the studio, and my character, one of my characters, works there. And then the other famous person who's real in the book is the Tsar and Tsarina's mother, the Empress Maria, who was very much a real person. And most of what I write about her in the book, she's a very strong character that comes in a third of the way before the end. Everything about her is pretty much true, except that we don't know that she ever went to England on this secret mission. But she never did believe that her son and her grandchildren and her daughter-in-law had been killed. She believed her son had been killed, but she never believed that the Romanov children had actually been killed. She always left out hope that they had survived.
Oh, that's interesting. I talked with the managing editor of the London Times magazine supplement, James, his last name escapes me right now, but we've talked with him a couple of times, and he always includes a real historical character in his novels. And I asked him this question, I'd like to ask you the same. What kind of sense of responsibility do you feel when you include someone in your fiction? Do you take the approach, well, it's fiction? I'm guessing you research quite a bit about them, actually, just based on what you've just said.
I do. I did with Maria. Anna Ladd isn't actually a main character, so I only did research on the studio, but what the studio in the book looks like is what it really looked like. I found pictures of it. I do an enormous amount of research. I feel very responsible that I keep to the spirit of the person. A lot of my characters are minor. A lot of the famous people that I use are minor characters in history, and it would be very hard to find out as much about them as I need to. In The Witch of Painted Sorrows, one of the famous people in there is the painter Gustave Moreau,
mm-hmm.
and I went to his house, I went to his studio. I mean, he's only in a couple scenes, but it's not just for the reader that I do it. It's that the more research I can do on the famous people of the time, the more it helps me imagine being there.
Yes.
It's hard to be there. I mean, you know, I'm writing about hundreds of years in the past. And in the last book, Henri Matisse is a young man who's a student at the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And I got three books about Henri Matisse's student days, and there isn't anything about him in the book except his name is mentioned once in the Witch of Painted Sorrows. But reading about his life as a student during those times enabled me to write about that character's life as a student during those times. So that research gives me something that's not always obvious to the reader.
Yes. One of the things you mentioned last time was how you, about 3 months before writing the book, you start building a journal of your character to give you a sense of, you know, who they are, etc. I'm wondering what went into that journal, some of the highlights that went into that journal when you were writing this book, The Secret Language of Stones.
Oh, I'm so flattered that you remember that.
I loved it because I do the same kind of thing with all kinds of projects.
This book is very different because Opaline is a jeweler. Her journal is a sketchbook that I sketched jewelry designs in.
Mm-hmm.
And I always take notes in the journal as I'm doing research. But then the things that belong to the character this time became very, very much about her jewelry design. And so I had so much fun because I love jewelry. And I went to Paris. I went to the Van Cleef & Arpels jewelry school to take classes in order to learn how jewelry is made to write this book. And so I wrote notes while I was there, things that I thought she saw, what she wore, but lots and lots of designs of her jewelry. And so, because the book is peppered with her jewelry designs, so I didn't want to use someone else's. I wanted them to be original. So I had so much fun learning about jewelry and going to jewelry school and then designing jewelry. Now I just want to make it all.
Yeah, you have art in your background, right? I think remember reading that if you weren't a writer, you'd like to be an artist.
Well, that's really what I wanted to be. And I went to art school and I studied printmaking and painting and art history. And I just wasn't as good at it as I needed to be to make a living. So I wound up going into advertising and then that led me into writing.
Mm.
But yeah, I always thought I was going to be an artist.
Right. And so you designed the talisman. Let's talk a little bit about the talisman, because you put a lot of work into designing that, I read.
Well, that was so interesting. This happens to me a lot, and I think we talked about this a little bit last time. I come up with something, and then I sort of very often find out that it already existed before I even knew that I was, I think I'm making it up, and then I find out that I wasn't making it up at all. So I had this idea of a talisman that would be made of crystal, because I, in studying jewelry design, I found out that every stone stands for something. And crystal is a very psychic stone that enables you to reach other dimensions. And so, of course, I had to make the crystal, I had to make the talisman out of crystal so that she could have the psychic experience. And then I sort of designed it in my head, and then I started looking around, and I found that there was a jeweler in New York, Temple St. Clair, who made talismans and amulets that look surprisingly like the one in my head. And so I had to get one. I found a secondhand one in the state piece in a jewelry store, and I wore that the whole time I was writing. I never took it off when I was writing so that I could be connected to it. But then I went to Scotland doing research for a book that I haven't read yet, and there in the museum in Scotland was an exhibit of witches, items that belonged to witches hundreds and hundreds of years ago, and there I found the exact same talisman, albeit the gold is beaten and not as finessed as the gold on the one that I bought, and the fact that it belonged to a witch made it just completely amazing, because the witch had used it in very much the way that my character used it, but I thought I was making that up. And as it turns out, I didn't make it up.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Really, isn't that interesting how the subconscious works? I mean, maybe somewhere you saw, you know, a million years ago, a picture, and it just pops in. That's very interesting. So you have just about everything in this book. There's art, there's magic, there's passion, there's intrigue. I know that you said you used to write, and maybe still do or will at some point, contemporary fiction, and then you dove into this historical fiction. Did you have as much fun writing this as you did the last one? Because you said you'd had such fun and got lost in the whole time period.
Yeah, you know, actually, this one has turned out to be my favorite book that I've ever written.
Oh, wow.
Because I just fell in love with the ghost. I just became so, what happened was, when I went to Paris for the week to go to jewelry school, it was in November, and it was very cold, and it was very gray, and it rained a lot, and I was by myself, and it was the first time I'd gone to Paris, actually ever, by myself, and I was very lonely. I was staying in an area that I always stay in, but I usually, when I go with my husband, we rent a little apartment. This time I stayed in the little bed and breakfast, and I was very, very lonely, and I kept thinking, this is so weird, why am I so lonely? And then I realized it was because my character was lonely, and I kind of gave into the being lonely, and I spent the 10 days, I have friends in Paris, but I didn't see any of them, and I just let myself be by myself the whole week and take my jewelry classes and go to museums and do research, and while I was there doing that, every instance of what I was researching turned out to be a surprise. There are letters in the book that the main character, the soldier, wrote before his mother, before he died. And the letters each take her to a different place in Paris. And so when I was there, I went to all those places, and I had an idea of what she would find there. But in each case, something strange happened to me, and I found something different than what I thought I was going to find. And I really felt like Jean-Luc, who is the main male character, I really felt like he existed and he was with me the same way that she would have felt that he was with her as a ghost. I just felt that he was there with me.
Right.
And I fell in love with him.
Fell in love with him, too.
and I just, I mean, even now talking about it, I'm almost crying every time I read the end of the book, which I had to do over and over as I was writing it. You have to edit it a million times. Every time I got to the last chapter, I burst into tears every single time.
Wow.
And I still, just talking about it, get like that. So it really is a very, it's going to be a very special book for me for a very long time. I'm going to love other books, but there's something very unique about this. I've wanted to write a ghost story since I was 12 years old, and I just really wound up being very happy with it.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. It is a very special book. The Publishers Weekly Review said the complex protagonist and evocative prose will appeal even to readers who don't, as a rule, enjoy the paranormal. So the reading is wide open there. Listeners can find out more about MJ Rose at her website, mjrose.com. The book is The Secret Language of Stones. And MJ Rose, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for being such a sensitive, wonderful interviewer. I love talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay.
And listeners, you can find out, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, and at info@conversationslive.com. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.